Freddie, go ahead.
Yeah, good evening, comrades, and thanks for that talk, Adam. Not unsurprisingly, very interesting. I mean, for the moment, though, I'd just like to make 2 points on it, though, and I'm referring to the slides. And whether or not yourself and perhaps other party members would still subscribe or would subscribe to the view just now that was expressed in the resolution I'm looking at it here is slide 3, motion 26, where it talks about the resolve that the SP that trade unionism is a necessity under capitalism to prevent the workers being continuously driven to sell the labour power below its value. Well, my sort of reading in that is, I'm not entirely convinced that trade unionism does prevent the workers being continuously driven. In fact, that many examples can be given, and I think you gave one partially earlier on, Adam, that it doesn't always prevent workers having their labour power set below its value. And I just wonder if perhaps such a motion saying that to prevent would be more opportune to resist the workers being continuously driven. And also, on slide 4, forgive me if you think I'm going on a bit long here, but again in slide 4, with the party resolved that trade unionism is necessary for the establishment of socialism. Well, I'm not entirely convinced about that either. And I just wonder what yourself would say to that, to those 2 points, under capitalism to prevent workers, and in slide 4, is necessary for the establishment of socialism. Thanks.
Adam, do you want to reply?
Yeah. No, I think that by and large, under capitalism, workers do get paid the value of their labour power. In other words, they get paid enough to keep themselves in working order, in order to recreate and maintain the quality of their labour power. And so the labour they're going to do for the capitalists. I mean, statistics have shown that in unorganized industries, once there's a trade union organized, they can get wages up to say up 10%, but after that, they can't do much more. In other words, organizing in trade unions can ensure that you don't get paid less than the value of labor. I mean, I think that I quite like that slide 3. As quite a good definition as to why not just socialists but why workers should join in trade unions and put pressure to maintain wages and working conditions. I mean, okay, you're resisting downward pressures, but sometimes you can if the labour market is tight, you can also push up wages. On the second point, I mean, I put that in that slide 4 in. I, on my notes, I've written curiosity, but I mean, I don't think it means it depends on what you mean by the word trade unionism. As I said, trade unionism in Britain, or at least at the time, didn't necessarily mean the existing trade unions. It means any economic organization, industrial organization of workers. And it seems to me that, okay, we, in the course of the establishment of socialism, you have the political party getting control of political power, but you'll still need to keep production going during that period and immediately after that. And I think this slide 4 was trying to convey is that workers would need to organise not just into a socialist political party, but they need to be organised in their places of work, ready to continue production. So I don't think, as I say, it doesn't literally mean that the existing trade unions are necessary for the establishment of socialism, but it means, I think, that some form of organisation in places of work will be necessary.
Okay, Adam, we've got Howard now, who's got a point to make. Go ahead, Howard.
Thanks, Dougie. If I can just pick up something that Freddie said, and I sort of take on board this thing about prevent. Slide three says trade unionism is a necessity under capitalism to prevent the workers being continuously driven to sell their labour power below its value. Freddie is suggesting resist would be a better word. I think he's right there, because the implication of that is that trade unions can always do that. And quite often they can't, unfortunately. I mean, you know, if I take the employment sector that sort of I've been involved in all my life, which is the higher education sector, there's no doubt that, and it's well established and agreed that in the last, say, 10 years, taking into account inflation, pay has gone down in the higher education sector by something like 10 or 11%. People are aware of that, and they're not happy with it. But nevertheless, they are not prepared to take the necessary action to prevent that continuing, simply because they believe that for one reason or the other, it won't work, or for whatever reason. So they, in a sense, what trade unions are doing is resisting this, saying it's wrong and we must do something about it. We call upon employers to look again and so on. But the employers don't want to. There's nothing the trade unions can do if their members don't want to do it to prevent this sale of labour power below its value. What that means in effect in the real world is that, you know, people's pay being cut from what it was before, or people's pay not on the whole representing the value of their labour power.
Okay, thanks, Howard. Do you want to reply, Adam?
Well, that was just the wording of one particular resolution. No, I agree that trade union action is essentially defensive. It's trying to prevent things getting worse, but in periods of labour shortage, it can also push up wages faster than they might otherwise do, because of the play of the law of supply and demand. But I can agree, actually, that the word resist might have been a better word to have used at that time. But as I say, the unions are essentially defensive organisations of workers under capitalism.
Okay, thanks, Adam. Moggy's got a point to make. Come on, buddy, Moggy.
Thank you. Yes, thanks very much, Adam. This is a subject that's very close to my heart, because I was a union deputy for British Actors Equity many years ago. I believe that unions really do their very best to help and support workers and fight for their rights. But the trend now seems to be to discourage people from joining unions. And in a lot of cases, people cannot join unions. You get people that are working on individual contracts, people that are working on 0 hours contracts, all sorts of casual workers who have no protection at all. So there's no one they can go to. You know, they're treated abominably, and there's no one they can appeal to stick up for them. So that's certainly the case in New Zealand. I don't know how bad it is in Britain. Thank you.
Thanks, Moggy. Adam, do you want to comment on that?
No, it's true that there are. I mean, you know, at the last place where I was working, there were people on, most of us were full-time, civil servants for life. But the other people were on short-term contracts and so on. But, I mean, our union did try to organise these people as well. But on the, I think there are smaller unions even in Britain. I think what's left of the IWW in Britain does try to organise some of these very low paid workers, like cleaners and so on, with some success. But of course, Howard had mentioned, even if you know, university lecturers are not prepared to stick their neck out. You know, people who are on the minimum wage will be even less prepared to do that. But I mean, there are attempts by not the mainstream unions, but by people to organise casual workers.
Okay, nobody else in the speaking queue at the moment. Let's see if anybody wants to make a comment. Oh, yeah, I've got Freddie again. Freddie, go ahead.
I'm not trying to hog the show here, but I think the fair point's been made. Let me be clear. Those of you that certainly know me will know that, I mean, I've been in a trade union for well over 50 years and recognise the value of them at times. But for me, what I've experienced and experienced it as a full-time official for quite a number of full-time trade union official for quite a number of years was that the unions were starting to become more inclined in trying to use legislation in terms of resisting pay cuts, etc. And I'm well aware, I'm sure we're all well aware, that this question of workers getting their labour power value, it certainly seems to me that overall, that I mean, many workers that I've known maybe get an hourly rate of whatever it might be, and 4, 5, 6 years later, I know they're still getting the same hourly rate. So if their labour value was worth, say, £5 an hour 5 years ago, and they're still only getting £5 an hour 5 years later, the labour value isn't been maintained. And, you know, the party's quite right, of course, to recognise that there is a value in unions. But this whole question, things like the national minimum wage getting introduced a number of years ago, what was happening there is that for me, from what I'd seen from the position I was in, it invariably became the maximum wage in some areas. The unions have a value, there's no doubt about that. But they can also be very insular in their own way. Thanks.
Thanks, Freddie. Do you want to reply, Adam?
Just on one point. It's true that what has happened over the last 30 or so years, or 40 years, is that legislation has introduced individual rights for workers. So that workers can, in theory, you know, go to an industrial tribunal, and they can win their personal case. And of course, there are all sorts of lawyers and lawyers' firms which specialises in this. Whereas in the past, this would have been done, by the unions. And it's another reason why presumably there's less enthusiasm for unions. And I mean, some of these unions that I've mentioned, they're offering all sorts of benefits, aren't they? You can get cheap holidays, you can get all sorts of health care and so on and so forth, which wasn't really the point of unions, but it's what they've become.
Okay, thanks, Adam. Howard's got a point to make. Go ahead, Howard.
Just to change the subject a bit, can I say, or can Adam say, or anyone say, or make comment on the Trot influence in the unions? It's well known that the Trotskyist, Socialist Workers' Party, etc., try constantly to use the unions for their own ends. You know, they sort of industrial action is part of their agenda. For raising consciousness, et cetera, nothing to do with the real needs of the workers in a particular industry at any given time. They sort of step in there where they can. And what I find interesting is that they sort of rant and rave about what Margaret Thatcher did in the 80s when she made it impossible for officials to declare strikes. There had to be a ballot of members, and they ranted and raved. They said that this was anti-union legislation. Actually, being a great supporter of Margaret Thatcher, I thought it was very good legislation for the unions, because it actually meant that any strike action taken would be democratic. So inadvertently, obviously Thatcher didn't mean it like that. I think it was a good thing from the socialist and from the democratic point of view. And a similar thing happened sort of 3 or 4 years ago when the current Tory government. He did pass a raft of anti-trade union legislation. It's true, but one of the aspects of this was that it forced a 50% turnout in a ballot in order for such a ballot to be valid. And people screamed about this. This is anti-trade union legislation. It will kill unions. I thought it wasn't bad, to be honest, because what it meant again is that if there was going to be industrial action, then it was best if the majority of workers, the majority of people in the union voted for it. In the old days, what used to happen was you'd get industrial action because there was a very small turnout. Maybe 20% of the union membership would vote. There'd be a vast majority in favour. And then there'd be industrial action, which would flop completely because very few people took it. And you've got a situation now in which that can no longer happen. I think from a democratic point of view, that's a good thing. And also it sort of lessens the potential influence for bad, in my opinion, of the Trotskyists, who sort of are constantly trying to take over trade unions for their own political ends.
Thanks, Herb. Do you want to comment, Adam?
Yeah, in slide five, the second point is that trade union organisation action should be democratic, with decision-making power in the hands of the members, or those on strike, not union officials. But I hesitant to say that this should be imposed by the state. I think it's something that should be decided by the by the members themselves. But I think that legislation that was introduced to have votes before a strike, it's backfired, because in the vast majority of cases, workers have voted to back what the union officials. I'm not talking about necessarily Trotskyist ones, but the ordinary union officials. Have recommended, but because they know that a vote for a strike will strengthen the hands of the negotiators. I mean, the other democratic reform, if you like, that was introduced was that the union officials had to be re-elected every 5 years. And I think they also said that the unions have to vote every 5 years on whether or not to have a political fund. But okay, these might be welcome things in the abstract, but I've got my doubts about saying they were good legislation passed by a Tory government. The intention wasn't actually what has happened. It's backfired on the anti-union people.
Sorry, Adam. Yeah, I entirely agree. That's exactly what I was trying to say, actually.
Okay, thanks, Howard. Yeah, Mike's got a point to make. On you go, Mike.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for that. Yeah, it's been an interesting talk and discussion so far. I've never joined a union myself. Although I'm thinking of it, and I'm about to start a new job, so that might be an opportunity to join one. And IWW. Is one I'll look into a bit more. I haven't joined a union up till now, partly through laziness, if I'm honest, and partly through stinginess with not wanting to pay the dues. And I remember Adam pointing out to me a while back about opting out of a proportion of the dues payments going to the Labour Party, which I didn't realise you could do beforehand. Part of my previous objection was because I thought I'd automatically be funding the Labour Party. I realise that's now not the case. But my Yeah, part of my hesitancy about joining a union is that I think there's something reformist about them. I realise reformism isn't quite the right word because obviously that applies more in the political arena rather than the economic one that that unions operate in. But I think some of the objections to reformism still apply in that if you're channeling your energy into making things better in the short term, which certainly has a place, but it can potentially sort of divert from a revolutionary goal. But my main question was, for many years I work for a housing association, which was all it was quite a large one and quite corporate in how it operated, and that didn't recognise unions, and it had a one of those staff associations instead, which was, you know, a watered down supposedly to compensate for not recognising a union. But I'd like Adam or someone else to maybe clarify to what extent capitalist organisations can say that they don't recognise a union. Or are there certain things that an organisation can't ignore union strength in? Are capitalist organisations at liberty to say, yeah, we don't recognise a union, no matter how many members, no matter how many employees are part of a union? So, yeah, maybe if someone could raise my awareness and fill in some of my blanks on that side of things. To what extent can capitalist structures ignore unions and their potential strength? Yeah, thank you.
Okay, Adam, do I reply to that, Adam?
Well, I think Freddie will be able to reply to it more than me, but he's more old favour what's going on in Britain in the last few years. But I think legally there's nothing to compel an employer to recognise a union. But of course there are certain advantages for an employer to recognise a union because they can have an accepted wage structure and things like that. So I think it'd be very foolish of an employer to refuse to recognize a union if in fact most of the members wanted to. But I mean there are some backwoods people around somewhere. But I don't think in this country you can force an employer to recognize a union. I think you might be able to in America. As I say, Freddie probably knows more about this current state of legislation than I do.
Adam,
yeah. Paddy, you go ahead now. Just following on from what Mike was saying, I have been in unions during various jobs. So I must be of the Jack Bradley school. I was a union member, but I was never particularly an activist. But saying that, even being a union member was quite unusual in a lot of the jobs I've had. And I was really struck by the sort of degree of anti-union attitudes among workers and also young people. I mean, I had one job supervising young people on benefits and things like that, and they were all dead anti-union. And I was really amazed. I thought, these are people who've got very poor prospects, low qualifications, and they're clearly quite angry about their situation in life, and they're anti-union, and I just found that really hard to understand. But this was back in the Thatcher years, so I mean, there was a sort of onslaught of Tory propaganda against the unions in those days. But also workers would say things like, oh, I'm not prepared to pay £8 a month, for a union that doesn't do anything. Like, I bet they pay more than that for, various insurance policies they've got. But they didn't see it in the same way. They just saw unions as a bit like plumbers. They're people that if you spring a leak, you call the union out. But otherwise, you pay them no attention. And you never go to meetings or anything. I would just reminded of what Moggy was saying about how work has changed its nature. So you've got zero hour contracts and, you know, the gig economy. And I wonder if that's why, talking to people in the IWW, they've told me that their membership has grown a lot in the last 10 years, sort of bucking the trend, I would have thought, of kind of, you know, sort of radical left groups. So I don't know if that's a response to the change. Well, they certainly sort of thought it was a response to the changing type of work that, you know. So perhaps that's a matter of the question of the socialist union question being revisited. But I'd like to ask Adam two questions, actually, just I'm not just rambling here. I'm working towards something. I'm assuming, and I suppose it's perhaps a sort of assumption that we've all got to some extent, that the level of membership of trade unions can be seen in some sense as a sort of as an analogue for the degree of class consciousness. So, you know, so if there's nobody in a union, it seems extremely unlikely that you've got any kind of significant class consciousness present. So given that question, given that assumption, we'll remember stories about how aggressive the French unions can be when they go on strike and they block motorways and things like that. And my own experience of living in Europe and seeing how common strikes were, I'd like to ask Adam first of all, how does he think the level of the unionisation in the UK? How does it compare to union activity in other countries? You know, for example, Europe, possibly America. I don't know if how much Adam knows about that, but I think it would be interesting to compare levels. And the second question is quite current, actually, because there's estimated to be a global labour shortage of about 40 million at the moment. I wondered if Adam would care to speculate on what effect that is likely to have on union membership, either just in the UK or globally. So those are the two questions.
Thanks, Paddy. Adam, do you want to answer those two questions?
Well, there's three, actually.
Yeah, I didn't realise.
Well, I mean, the first one is about the trade union consciousness. I think Lenin famously said that the workers are only capable of acquiring a trade union consciousness, which wasn't just the to organise the trade unions, but to press for labour legislation and so on. And I suppose that is a measure. Trade union consciousness is a measure of. Of some minimal class consciousness, but I think probably it's that has declined certainly since the 1970s. On the second question is, I can only speak about unions in Belgium and in France. In Belgium. There's an advantage in being a member of a trade union because the trade unions administer the unemployment and sick pay benefits. I mean, that's why, in fact, you've got a liberal, you know, which is a party of the capitalists, a liberal trade union as well. People who don't want to join the Catholic Union or the so-called Socialist Union. You have to be in a union to get your sick pay and unemployment pay quickly. But in France, it's true that the unions are more militant and they employ more militant tactics. But it comes back to what Howard was saying. Most people in most workers in France don't join trade unions. But so what the unions are is they're associations of activists. Who they believe in minority action, and historically they always have. I mean the French unions before the First World War, at the time the party was formed, were organized on that basis that you a minority an active minority gains control of the union and then launched into militant action, which generally in fact ended in a defeat. So although the French unions adopt more militant tactics, they're not, if you like, not democratic tactics. On the last question, what, 40 million people throughout the world, there's a labour shortage. I don't know what effect that will have on individual countries, but whenever there is a labour shortage, then it puts the workers in a stronger bargaining position. Even if the law of supply and demand will lead to an increase in wages anyway, whenever there's a shortage and until it's overcome. But I don't know. I mean, there isn't, as we know, there isn't free movement of people into Europe or into America or into Japan. So whether this would have any effect, I don't know. But on the other hand, if there's a labour shortage in Britain, and when there was in the 1950s, they did import workers from the old colony. So if that situation did develop in Britain, they would do that. In fact, they are now allowing people in, aren't they, from Hong Kong, many more than them across the channel in boats.
Thanks, Adam. Yeah. Freddie's next. Would you like to have a go, Freddie?
Yeah, it's just in part to answer the point that Mike was asking there. But before doing that, I can say, what Howard just was talking about earlier on in terms of the SWP and the sort of former militant, is absolutely correct in that, and the way that those organisations really try to move stones all over the place to try and get a hold on branches, etc. But of course, one of the effects of that was that the sort of leadership of the union I was in at the time anyway, they were doing everything possible then to make it even more centralised at head office and in regional offices, etc. So every time, say, when the SWP were raising their heads, there was always a counteraction. And then when it came to conferences, etc., much of it was already, to my mind, stitched up beforehand to resist what the SWP and militant were trying to do. And whilst they may have won one or two pockets somewhere in terms of control of the local branches, I don't believe they made any huge significant impact. But anyway, and the point that I'm sure it was Mike was making there about trade union recognition, there is legislation, and I believe it's still in action, and it's called the Central Arbitration Committee, where employees in a workforce. And I think it was something, forgive me, I can't remember precisely, it goes back a lot of years when I was involved in it, but it was the Central Arbitration Committee, and if a union could show that something like 75%, it was quite a high percentage of employees of employees were wishing to be in a union, then union recognition could be forced upon the employer. It was a very, very high bar to get through. And I recall in terms of myself, where a group of schools, I'll obviously not mention this group, but they deal primarily, or they employed primarily people who were caring for autistic children. They had a various group of schools up and down the country. And I'd been quite heavily involved in recruiting in these schools, certainly in the Yorkshire area. I was quite heavily involved in recruiting. And the union had to end up taking this group to the Central Arbitration Committee because recruited very heavily. So in effect, the question I think that Mike was asking there, yes, there is legislation that unions can use to seek to force an employer to recognise the union, unless that's changed in the last few years, where I'm not as active. Well, I'm not active in the union now. Thanks.
Thanks, Freddie. Want to comment, Adam, or we'll just move on to Paul.
No, move on to Paul. That's good.
Yeah, Paul, you're next, Paul.
Okay, yeah. I'd like to make a couple of points, both in relation to something that Howard said. Firstly, it's all to do with this 50% thing. In the union I'm in, there have been examples where members have, as it were, not voted against as a kind of way of cutting the percentage of those who vote. Since in most voting on taking industrial action, among those who vote, there's a fairly large majority for action. And there was one case where I think it was if the union branch didn't get the 50% level, but if another dozen people or so had voted against, and they would have got above the 50% threshold. So this 50% thing is actually sort of undemocratic in that sense, because those who oppose industrial action can simply abstain as a way of helping to keep down the numbers who vote. If you look at this by-election the other day, I think it was something like 30-odd percent of the electorate voted in that. And of course, the government doesn't say, oh, that's undemocratic. We can't have an MP who's only elected by such a small number of people. So this 50% thing really is completely undemocratic. And that's, of course, it's intended to be. The other point I wanted to make, I don't want to boast, but I was helping out on a picket line yesterday and the day before. And at one point, I was given a leaflet by someone from the Socialist Equality Party, which is a Trotskyist outfit. I think they're a kind of descendant of the WRP. And, of course, they were going on about leaders and so on. But they, I think, were trying to be, I think, even more, if you like, extreme than the SWP, saying that the sort of union officials and leaders who the SWP were quite keen on, yet the Socialist Equality Party thought they were just as bad as everybody else, really. And I said to the guy that this is the kind of thing you hear from Leninists who are obsessed with leadership. And he wasn't very, very impressed by that kind of argument. So even within the Trotskyists and so on, there were disputes and disagreements as to which lot of officials and leaders to support. And some people think the SWP are really just part of the establishment, if you like. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Paul. That was interesting. Yeah. Adam, do you want to comment on that?
Not really, except, I mean, that you'd expect that the Trotskyists to do that. That's their thing, isn't it? They're a vanguard party, and they want to lead the workers, so they want to get into positions in the in the trade union. But in fact, I used to work for a trade union as well, which was the National Union of Mine Workers, and they're really three types of trade unions. There's there's the established officials, and then there's the militants, and then there's the the rest of the membership. And basically, what you saw was the two minority groups sort of vying for control and trying to lead the others. So these organizations, it was the Communist Party in my day, it was the Communist Party. So you've got two groups of rival leaders, the establishment, pro labor right wing type people, and then you've got I say the old Communist Party nowadays, militant, and the SWP. In fact, most party members that I've talked to who've been in unions, all sorts of unions, actually resent the what the Chossies are doing is what you'd expect. I mean, they don't get involved in that type of union politics. I think, I mean, for instance, in the recent election for the general secretary of Unite, I think Militant backed one candidate, and the SWP backed another. So they, as Freddie was saying, and as Paul was saying as well, that they fall out with each other because they're rivals.
Thanks, Adam. There's nobody else in the speaking queue at the moment. It's about 8:45 or whatever, but we can carry on. Steve Finch wants to have a go. Okay, Steve, on you go.
Hey, thanks, Dougie. Just a question about, possibly Freddie might have a view on this, about, what was it called, check-off, when you get your union subs taken out of your wages? I've heard people argue that that's a really bad idea in this country, and it would be far better if the union officials, branch officials, would collect dues, for example. And I've seen this in action in South America. This is very anecdotal, this, about the way that trade unions appear to work in Argentina and Uruguay. They're so ensconced. I think this is partly due to the history of Peronism. So ensconced in the system that workers seem to tend to view trade unions as a service, a bit like was mentioned beforehand about these unions offering bloody cut price orders and stuff like that. So it definitely, like my wife at the moment is trying to get some sort of representation where she works, and it doesn't seem to be at all likely, because people don't seem to think that trade unionism requires any sort of action on their behalf. It's something that's done for you. I don't know, just like possibly Freddie or Adam's got a view on that.
Okay, Adam, do you want to reply to that?
Yeah, I think I don't know all that much about the situation of trade unions in South America, but I think they're more politicized. I know that our party in India has a different attitude to trade union question than our party, and they justify it on these type of grounds that the unions in India are organized by political parties, and workers and socialists shouldn't have anything to do with them. But what they should do is organize themselves into workers' committees to press their immediate trade union interests. But I think we can say, in fact, that as a party, we support the principle of trade unionism, bargaining over wages and resisting downward pressures. But we don't support individual trade unions. So it's quite possible for party members. In fact, it had happened, but there have been party members in rival trade unions. I mean, there was one member who was very active in the Transport and General Workers Union, and another member who was the secretary of a breakaway union on the docks. So you had party members in rival unions. But as I say, to come back to your point, I think that outside of Britain, the unions are more tied to political parties than they are here. I mean, in here they're tied to one political party, the Labour Party, but in other countries they're tied to different rival political parties, which makes them sort of mass basis for a party. I think this is the case in the West Indies and places like that. The trade unions are much more political party-like than actual unions, as we understand them.
Yeah, thanks, Adam. Yeah, Freddie wants to have another go. Come on in, Freddie.
Well, yeah, thanks, Doug. I mean, it's really just to pick up on the point that Steve was asking there. Actually, took me back well over 50 years. This, well, not well over 50 years, but 50 years and a little bit. When I was first a shop steward, I used to go around collecting dues of the members in the branch that were at, because there was no check-off system at the time. Well, not one that I was aware of, and this was in the local authority. They had no check-off system at that time. And one of the things I found advantageous about it, as I was a pretty young shop steward at that time, was that it kept you in touch with the members going actually round collecting the dues from them, you know. So it had that advantage. Of course, one of the advantages in when check-off systems started getting introduced was that certainly in terms of income for the union, they knew what they were getting, more or less, unless members just decided to opt out. So I think there is some merit in the check-off system, but also, as I say, but keeping in touch with fellow trade union members, I found that quite useful. A little bit like, if you even look at the party, probably quite a few of us have got direct debits now in terms of making a contribution to the party, whereas historically you go along to the branch meeting to pay your dues or whatever. That's when dues, you know, well, they were always been optional, but that's when you went along to the branch meeting and paid your dues. So I can see merit in the check-off system.
Thanks, Freddie. Yeah, yeah. Do you want to mention anything about that, Adam?
Of course, the structure of our party is based on the structure of a trade union at the time the party was formed. You can see that, as Freddie was just saying. You pay your dues at the branch meeting, or you pay your dues at the union meeting, and quite a few of our procedures and rules and so on would reflect those of union at the time. There was one union, I think, that was formed about that. The cab drivers union before the First War. They used to have any member could attend the meeting of the executive committee. But of course, now you've got the unions are huge organizations. I'm trying to remember my union dues were deducted at source. I'm not sure they could have been, because I didn't pay the political levy, and I can't imagine the employer's system, only taking so much off, depending whether or not you paid the political levy. When I was in working on the contract, I paid by standing order, and still do. But I can see the advantage of not having a checkout system, because Freddie said, it means that the union rep has to. Actually, can meet the members and talk to them and find out what their grievances and things are, which you don't have with the check-off system. I think I would be in principle opposed to it, because it's some sort of collaboration, isn't it, with the with the employer.
Yeah, thanks, Adam. Steve again.
Yeah, just to come back on that, it is remote, and it just becomes like social
space. Steve, you're breaking up a bit,
Okay, leave it. I was just going to repeat something. Sorry about that.
Nobody in the speaker. Can I make a point? I know somebody who's a shop steward for Unison or whatever, and she works at the university. A lot of her job as a union shop steward is representing people that have done bad things. One thing I would like to know, what's the union attitude to people having to have the COVID vaccine to work in the NHS and work in care homes. What are the unions saying about that kind of thing? Because people could lose their jobs because they've been stupid enough not to have the vaccine or whatever.
All I can say on that last point is when they tried to do that in the French West Indies, which was resulted in riots and cars being burnt and things like that. So I don't think that would happen in Britain, but it doesn't seem fair that somebody should lose their job.
Thanks, Adam. It's Paul Edwards next. Paul, do you want to go ahead?
Yeah, cheers. Thanks, Dougie. Lovely, terrific session again tonight. Marvellous contributions. And Adam, you and I, we both know I recognise NatSopa particularly well, having been a member of that until it eventually amalgamated with SOGAT. So, yeah, I got a lot of fond memories of my life in those trade unions a long, long time ago. I mean, I think there's certainly no doubt. I've sort of moved away from that now, and I'm fortunate enough to be one of those dual membership holders insofar as I've been a member of Unite, retired members branch based in Ayrshire for many years. But I'm also a member of the IWW, which is, of course, the global trade union and possibly the closest one to the same kind of values that we share in the Socialist Party. You know, one of the inscriptions on their banners is refers to quite clearly abolition of the wages system, which I was particularly attracted to when I first decided to join them. And they're an absolute terrific trade union. I would strongly recommend anyone taking up membership with them. They're just a great thing to be part of, with over a million members worldwide, many of them in America, having some of them having just won. We're talking about trade union recognition after many, many years battling. The IWW finally secured trade union recognition with Nabisco, one of the biggest kind of food processors in America, which was quite a notable success. I think in terms of the CAC, I covered a little bit of union legislation when I was doing the Open University Law degree, and the actual CAC, the CAC legislation, my understanding is that to have union recognition, there has to be at least 25 members, of which at least 40% has to request union recognition. And if the employer still doesn't do it, then it can go to arbitration and then they can be forced to be recognised. Now, that said, it's not always, again, you know, taking advantage of other employment legislation in the UK anyway, it's not always necessary to have trade union recognition in order to have the benefits. Anyone, whether a member of a union or not, is entitled to have a representative with them at any kind of disciplinary or any needs that may arise, and an employer cannot refuse that. So they could always get union representation. Of course, that's a separate issue to negotiations and things like that. But as I say, I personally, I mean, one of the advantages of being as Unite, as Adam touched on earlier, was the fact that, there are other advantages and benefits too on the side of just employ. Oh, sorry, just a minute. Quietly, please, guys. On the side of just employment matters, and that can include subsidies with gas and electric bills, insurance policies, and also access to legal advice, health benefits too. So, you know, I think when all is said and done, the important thing that I would say is it's better to be a member of a trade union than not. When both my older daughters went into employment, one of the first things I encouraged them borderline insisted that they do, but, you know, certainly gave them a very encouraging helping hand of the advantages and the benefits is to get and become a member of a trade union. You never know when you might need them. I mean, I can understand why a lot of people not keen on trade unions, you know, when they see some of these kind of fat cat trade union officials and full timers, you know, cutting a bit in their fancy cars and their big houses, and you know, I'm funding that. It's not a particularly nice mentality, but that's some of the thoughts that go through some workers' minds. And then lo and behold, when they need them, who's the first people they call but the union? The one thing I can say about the IWW, as opposed to some of the other more mainstream trade unions, is it's entirely voluntary, much like the Socialist Party of Great Britain. There are no paid members from top to bottom and sideways. I use the top to bottom thing figuratively, you know. Of course, there are union dues, and they're on a kind of sliding scale. But there is no paid employees, you know, nobody draws a wage from it. It's all strictly voluntary. They put on some terrific training courses, and they are a very active union. So certainly if someone is looking for a press union to think about, don't hesitate to consider the IWW. They've got some branches in all the major cities throughout the country, and they do an absolutely terrific job. So please do consider joining if you're so minded. Cheers.
Thanks, Paul. Yeah, there's nobody else in the speaking queue. It's just about 9 o'clock. I don't know when Adam wants to finish. Yeah.
Can I say something about the IWW?
Okay, Adam. Yes.
Look at slide two. In 1908, the ending was changed to read, "The class struggle must go on until the workers of the world organize as a class, take possession of the earth and the machinery of production, and abolish the wages system." I mean, that's obviously a better than what was in 1905. But I mean, personally, I've never seen the point of joining the IWW as a trade union. I always believe that if you should join the existing union, because you know unity is strength. And if you join the IWW and you're in a working in the civil service or in industry where there is already an existing union, the IWW can't do anything for you. It can only be a ginger group. I noticed that recently, in recent years, the IWW has changed its policy. One time, you could not be a member of the IWW and a member of another trade union, but they changed that. Now, I have no particular objection to party members being members of the IWW as a discussion group, but I believe that in Britain, they would just organise a few left-wing bookshops and vegan cafes. If you're going to join a union, you might as well join a big union, a union that's got some clout with the with the employers. So, as I say, I don't mind party members can join if they want to, but I've never seen the point of doing it myself.
Thanks, Adam. Paul, do you want to come back on that?
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously a fair comment, Adam, but I think the beauty is there's no harm in being a member of two unions if you're so minded, and it would be sensible to do so, because there's more to just being a member of a trade union than employment rights. There is mentions of, I mean, one of the things that I'll be working on when I return to Glasgow branch as a member of Clydeside is to try and introduce some of the members that I'm becoming closer with in the IWW to the Socialist Party. Now, that's not going to dilute the Socialist Party. That's going to help strengthen the mindset and the clarity of what's there. I mean, I think what I would be inclined to... Oh, someone tired? You get yourself off to bed, eh? I think what I would say as well is that there is also a bit of a myth about who they do and don't represent. they have a very, very high contingent of relatively highly skilled workers, including journalists and trade union and university lecturers, all the way across to road cleaners and cleaners of various sorts. I think it's also worth mentioning that they're in the process of trying to make some contact through Amazon and their employers by regularly leafleting those, you know, and trying to get a bit of a break there. So, yeah, certainly, you know, I totally respect what you're saying, Adam, but I would recommend, yeah, being a member of your big local trade union, but also considering the IWW too. Yes.
Adam, do you want to comment on that?
Well, not really. I mean, it's a point of view, but I wouldn't advise, Mike Foster to join the IWW if he wants a union that's going to represent him and do something for his wages and conditions. But if he wants to join, take part in a discussion group, you know, group on socialism or something like that, fair enough.
Okay, thanks, Adam. We've got Mike in the speaking queue, but yeah, he's been unmuted. Yeah. Mike, do you want to make a comment? Go ahead.
Okay, you're doing a good job tonight. Sorry, the cursor keeps going onto the mute and I hate to hit it. About the COVID vaccine, you're wondering what the trade unions say about that. Well, I used to be a trade unionist, so I'd like to say something on it. There's been 250 million cases throughout the world, the COVID virus. There've been very few, if any, died from getting the vaccine. But quite a number of people have died from getting the COVID. So there'd be, you know, if I was in the union, I'd be saying, go ahead and get the vaccine. If they're going to sack you, well, you know, it's your life. It's their people's life as well, though. So if you're not vaccinated and you catch it, you're going to kill people. So you have to consider that. Now, I was 24 hours in hospital about a month ago. And everybody in there, all the staff, all the doctors, all the nurses, they were all wearing the mask, wearing money about it. No big deal to get the vaccine. So, you know, I would say that. So, you know, you'd really have to take, are you going to kill people by getting COVID and passing it on, or are you going to save people?
Okay, thanks, Mike. Yeah, that's I'd agree with you on that. Anyway, I know what Adam thinks. Yeah.
Well, you want to know what I think? But I was just pointing out that in the French West Indies, the people who were about to be sacked, you know, the trade union supported them, and it resulted in riots and the police firing rubber bullets and so on. I mean, you've got to be careful about taking people's jobs away. That's all.
Okay, thanks, Adam. Good point, yeah. I muted myself. I don't know if anybody else wants to say anything. It's just after 9 o'clock, just after 9:05 or whatever. So maybe Adam could wind up unless anybody else wants to have a say. I don't think we've got anybody else. So, Adam, do you want to wind up on what you said and what people have said? And then we can finish the meeting. Yeah.
Okay, no, I mean, I think it was a good discussion, but looking down the list of participants, I see that quite a few who I know have been active trade unionists, but who said nothing. But, I think we all more or less agree that, the present union shouldn't be smashed, but that we should take part in them, both as workers and as socialists, which obviously oppose, you know, when they link with the Labour Party and political stuff like that. But we can go along with action on sound lines, which would be, you know, a class basis, democratically organised, and not linked to any particular political party. I think we're all agreed on it.
Okay, well, thanks, Adam. Thanks, everybody, for taking part. I think we'll call that a night. And people can make themselves a cup of tea or have a drink, depending on your social situation.